Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
It was embarrassing. I thought that was embarrassing.
And the dogs are tied to people who are on skis.
It's graffiti, I guess, but with knit fabric.
It's easy to understand it in your head. It's a different thing to try to bring it to your dinner table and explain it to your family and go, this is something I'm really keen on.
This week, from Cajun country to caretaker presidents.
From the studios of KUOM Radio K, this is Culture Cube, the arts show that rocks. Tickets are free and there's no wait, so take a seat and hold on to your radio.
Good evening, I'm your host, Mark Sheely. If you can't make it to New Orleans for Fat Tuesday, on our show tonight, Culture Q is bringing you just a few of the tastes and sounds that hail from Cajun country. And in our country, we've had our share of memorable presidents, but there are also many forgotten by America's history books. So in honor of President's Day, we'll be looking at the more remarkable happenings of America's most unremarkable leaders. And we may live in a global village, but it would all be babble without that fine art of translation. All this and more, so stick around, because it's time for Culture Q. Minneapolis and New Orleans may be an entire country apart, but that doesn't mean we can't appreciate the feasts of Mardi Gras in our own way. Culture Q producer Noel Clark took a foodie's journey to a Cajun cooking class and then stopped by a local restaurant that will pile your plate with crawfish and stuff you with hush puppies.
Mardi Gras, or Fat Tuesday, is the day before French Catholics in the South began fasting for Lent. In New Orleans, this means food. Cajun and Creole cuisine erupted in the South when cooking styles of French colonialists and locals merged.
It's really a Creole cooking itself is a hodgepodge of probably five different cooking cultures. Now, New Orleans itself was basically a French city.
This is Ben McCallum. He's the executive chef at Three Sons Catering in South Minneapolis.
So they have a very heavy base in it, and you'll see that through all styles. There's a lot of frying, there's a lot of dough batters, and the crustings and the cuts that you see are basically French.
Several times a year, Ben teaches cooking classes at Kitchen Window in Uptown Minneapolis. The name of this class is Mardi Gras Dinner Party.
I'm going to add some red onion again. See a little.
The menu consists of fried catfish, crawfish fritters, sweet potato and hominy hash, and collard greens. At the center of all this is what Ben refers to as the Holy Trinity.
Holy Trinity of New Orleans cooking and most Southern style cooking is green peppers, celery, and onions. It's used in 90% of all cooking as a base. Whereas in French cooking, it's a mirepoix, which is carrots, celery, and onions. So really, they've taken that base French again and added a pepper to it. A green pepper usually is what is in there to add, you know, a bite to it. And they omit the carrots because it's a little harder to cook. It doesn't stew as well.
Ben's love of cooking developed at an early age.
Well, my father was an executive chef, so the first thing I was really doing was peeling vegetables and learning how to do basic knife cuts.
Though trained classically in the French style, Ben considers himself more of a fusion chef.
Anytime that I do a Southern meal, I'm really delving into the roots of a French Creole style cooking. And I think that's kind of prevalent out from New Orleans itself and Louisiana, and it's surrounded the area with that style of cooking.
A style that itself relies heavily on improvisation, spices, seafood, and the need for a filling meal. For example,
a really great jambalaya, you know, a dish that is saucy, spiced but not spicy, served over a rice that's usually a little more bland to offset the spice. That's what I would really see as, like, if you went down there and you were going to go to somebody's house and eat something, they're probably going to be serving you a jambalaya. And everyone's jambalaya is different, you know, it depends on what's in your pantry at the time.
For you Midwesterners with empty pantries and no hope to get down to New Orleans for Mardi Gras this year, don't fret. You only need to go as far as downtown Minneapolis.
I'm Jonathan Flatt. I'm head chef at the Bullfrog Cajun Bar.
The menu at the Bullfrog has a heavy emphasis on Cajun food. But if frog legs and crawfish aren't your forte, Don't worry, you won't starve.
We do a lot of classic Cajun and Creole food, and in addition to a lot of different kinds of burgers and stuff that's bar food, it's accessible to everyone.
Having lived in New Orleans, Jonathan knows what it's like to miss home. That's why he provides a little bit of it to his customers.
I really like comfort food. It's kind of like I want to inspire memories. Like, so the highest compliment I can get is someone saying that, oh, that meal just reminded me of a meal I had when I was down there or was living down south.
Downtown working folk might be wondering where they fit in. Don't worry, they have po' boys.
Shrimp po' boy and catfish po' boy, probably those two are huge sellers here.
The catfish po' boy is huge. I definitely, I had one and it was a lot of food.
Awesome. Yeah, it is quite a bit of food and we kind of try to fill people up.
Jonathan's not content to stop there. The Bullfrog's menu is ever expanding, so if you're in the mood for that jambalaya, well, here it comes.
We're definitely going to add some jambalaya and some etouffee and some more classic Cajun and Creole dishes.
Whether you're trying your hand at cooking at home or just going out to have some food in the town, no meal is complete without good tunes.
I do like some Dixieland jazz, Louis Armstrong, stuff like that.
Jazz all the way.
Again, Ben McCallum.
Something with horns, something with a nice sax in the background, but it's got to be, you know, it's got to be pumping at the same time. It can't be the slow jazz that you would think of when you turn to a jazz station. It's got to be a lively, almost ska-ish type of jazz.
After just stuffing your face with so much food that you want to burst, go dance it off. That is, after all, the spirit of Mardi Gras. For Culture Q, I'm Noel Clark.
In honor of Mardi Gras, senior producer Zach McCormick digs into the history of a performer that's been synonymous with New Orleans music for the last 50 years, Dr. John.
Stride, Roomba, Boogie Woogie, R&B, Funk, you can call it whatever you want, but there's a special magic to the sound of New Orleans. It's a hot, swampy, voodoo sort of magic, and the good Dr. John crew has got it all bottled up for you. His medicine show has been touring for a half century now, but if he ain't been cured yet, there's still time. Born Mac Rebenack on November 21st, 1940, in the heart of the Crescent City, Dr. John took his name from a legendary 19th century voodoo healer. Originally a guitarist and session musician, the young Rebenack contributed to records by hometown heroes Professor Longhair and Joe Tex before he was even 20 years old. The early 1960s were a productive time for Mac. He scored a regional hit of his own on local label Rex Records with a Link Wray-style guitar instrumental called Storm Warning. Landing a lucrative job managing A&R at another record label, Rebenack's career seemed unstoppable. But Mac always had a calling to his city's more dangerous sectors.
Some people think they jive me, but I know they must be crazy. Don't see their misfortune.
One fateful night, Mac was shot in the left hand while defending his friend and bandmate Ronnie Barron in a bar fight. The wound crippled Rebenack's fingers and prevented him from playing guitar. Trouble with drugs and the law forced him to take a break from the Crescent City for a spell, and in 1963, he packed his bags and moved to the greener pastures of Los Angeles.
Walk on pins and needles, see what they can do. Walk on gilded splinters with the cane of the Zulu. Dang, I'm gonna come on, come on, come on, walk on gilded splinters.
Concentrating on his piano playing, Rebenack became a successful session musician once again, honing his chops on pop and blues records. By the late 1960s, Mac had developed a distinctively funky style all of his own on the keyboards and a new identity to go with it. Renaming himself Dr. John, the Night Tripper, he quickly drew a cult following with his impressive live shows, which incorporated Mardi Gras costumes and eerily authentic voodoo rituals. In 1968, the Night Tripper released his debut album, Gree-Gree, fusing his New Orleans R&B roots with a healthy dose of West Coast psychedelica. Retroactively considered one of the best and most exploratory albums of Dr. John's career, Gree-Gree baffled label heads at Atlantic initially, who wondered how they were supposed to sell this boogaloo crap that had been tracked hastily in the leftover studio time of a Sonny and Cher recording session. Hoping for a runaway hit, the label would rush him into the studio on a yearly basis with mixed results until 1971's The Sun, The Moon, and Herbs. The album can be seen as the last album of Dr. John's psychedelic Night Tripper period, but it was a fitting farewell and featured Eric Clapton on guitar and Mick Jagger on backing vocals, both of whom were devout fans of the Doctor's work.
Echo! Echo, 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 ande, Giacomo fino andande, Giacomo finale.
Finally on a roll, Dr. John recorded Gumbo in 1972 as a tribute to his native city. Featuring his interpretations of 11 New Orleans classics and only a single original, the album marked a decisive change in the Doctor's sound to a more R&B and funk-oriented style reflective of his hometown's famous brass bands. Teaming up with New Orleans hitmaker Alan Toussaint in 1973, Dr. John released his most commercially successful album, In the Right Place, with an even greater emphasis on the funky, danceable beat. The title track cracked the Billboard Top 10, but the real story here is the red-hot backing band, The Meters, who lent their innovative sound to an already stellar set of compositions. Eager for another hit, Atlantic went with the same formula on 1974's Destitively Bonnaroo, featuring Toussaint and the Meters once again. Despite incredibly funky results, the record failed to sell and chart and marked the end of what most considered to be Dr. John's classic period. 1978's City Lights was a critically lauded jazzy experimentation, but as time passed, the Doctor seemed to enjoy his role as a performer and interpreter of New Orleans standards far more than songwriting. He's remained that way for the last three decades, an unofficial but much beloved ambassador of the Crescent City's rich musical culture. And he's still touring at 71 years old, spreading a little bit of that swampy voodoo magic wherever he travels. Such a night. Happy Mardi Gras, y'all. I'm Zach McCormick for Culture Q.
You are listening to Culture Q, and right now we find ourselves only one day away from President's Day, and Tess, I have to admit, I don't know what I'm going to wear.
On President's Day.
I know. Right now I'm joined in the studio with Tess Weinberg, Culture Q producer.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
And in honor of this holiday, we thought that we would discuss the greater happenings of our lesser-known presidents.
Yes, exactly.
So, let's start out at the top of the list. Number seven.
All right, number seven is William McKinley. And I actually didn't know that a president existed named William McKinley before looking at this top seven. Did you know he existed, Mark?
I did. I'm kind of a history buff, but there were some presidents on this list that I would have never been able to name before this.
Well, the cool thing, the notable thing about William McKinley is that there was actually a $500 bill in circulation for a while back in 1934, and his face was on the dollar bill, and he was also assassinated, so.
I know. Yeah, usually you associate being on the dollar bill with being a really famous president like George Washington, Andrew Jackson.
Right.
Number six is a little bit more recent president that I imagine like all of our listeners have heard of. Number six is Gerald Ford, who became president after Nixon resigned from office. But something you may not know about Gerald Ford is he was actually a male model. If you look at pictures of him, like he, especially like while he was in office, he wasn't a very handsome guy. But he actually appeared on the cover of magazines like Cosmo.
It was probably,
yeah, he was a pretty handsome man.
Back in the day. Number 5 is William Henry Harrison, and some of you may know him as being or having the shortest term of any president after catching pneumonia during his inaugural speech. Isn't that just a sad way to go? That just makes me sad.
I know, but in a way he kind of brought it on himself. Like, he didn't have to give such a really long speech.
Yeah.
And he died 32 days in office, and he was succeeded by the next president on this list. President Tyler has the distinction of being very, very active in a certain way during his whole life. He fathered 15 children. 2 of his grandchildren actually survive to this day.
Wow, and that was a long time ago. He lived from 1790 to 1862, so...
Mm-hmm.
All right, next on the list, number 3, is Warren G. Harding. And what he's known for, it's a little bit saucy. He was said to have about 4 mistresses, one of whom he had intimate relations with in a White House closet. Talk about crazy things in the White House.
It's also rumored that he fathered an illegitimate child with one of these mistresses, and he was something of a old romantic. He wrote love poems.
Yeah, and Mark and I were actually reading some of them.
A little questionable to read on air, and just like embarrassing in general.
Yeah, to read out loud, but they were romantic. So if you want to check them out, head to the internet.
Head to the internet. Number 2 on this list is Zachary Taylor. If you could die by like eating anything, like you'd probably want it to be like something. Cool.
Right. Like risky. Like if you eat blowfish, isn't that like you're like it's Russian roulette, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, Zachary Taylor is believed to have died from eating too many cherries and too much milk on a hot summer day.
That's gross.
We come to our number 1 president, Mr. James Garfield.
Yes, he was shot in July of 1881 by Charles Gautier?
Guiteau, I think.
Guiteau?
Yeah.
My French is not very good.
He's kind of lamented for the kind of president he could have been. He was a very smart man. He was a great orator, and not terribly long into his term, he was shot. And it's the means of trying to save him that he's maybe a little bit more notable. For example, Alexander Graham Bell was brought in to develop like a metal detector to try to find one of the bullets. And, we remember Alexander Graham Bell for successfully inventing the telephone, right? Unfortunately, his invention here did not work as well because it just kept detecting the bed frame under Garfield and led doctors to just poke and prod his ailing body some more. And eventually, unfortunately, he died.
Bummer.
But, Alexander Graham Bell did eventually go on to invent the telephone. So it just goes to show that if at first you don't succeed in saving the president, try again and invent the telephone.
We are the mediocre presidents. You won't find our faces on dollars or on cents. There's Taylor and there's Tyler, there's Gilmore and there's Hayes. There's William Henry Harrison.
I died in 30 days.
Maybe you indulge in one too many crime novels, or you really are on the run from the law. Either way, it's always smart to have an exit strategy. So this week, Culture Q's newest reporter, Brittany Hansen, asks students around campus, if you had to flee the country, where would you go?
To Egypt, my country.
Yes?
Yes, I wanted to go back to my country.
I'll go to Nigeria, it's my country.
India, because I'm from there, and I miss Indian food a lot.
Ecuador? South America, yeah.
I would go to Machu Picchu because no one would follow me up the mountain.
I'd probably go to Hawaii, not leave the country, just go to Hawaii because I've been there before and it's real nice out there, so.
Yeah, I'd probably go to the Bahamas. I haven't been there yet. So, I've seen pictures, it look nice.
Yeah, I'd go to Luxembourg just because it just sounds nice.
I would go to Italy because it's beautiful and it's where my ancestors are from.
I would go to Romania because it's away from everything and it seems like a great place.
I would probably go to New Zealand because it's beautiful.
New Zealand because it's awesome.
I would go to Auckland.
Yeah?
New Zealand, Auckland. Because it's one of the most cleanest cities and it's pretty cool out there, yeah.
Switzerland? Just, you know, stereotype.
I would go to Switzerland because it's a very stable country and it's not very threatened by any other nations.
Yeah, not Iran, that's for sure.
I guess I'd flee to Canada because it's close by and I think it's doing okay.
I would go to Canada. Some more leniency on a couple of laws.
Canada? Free healthcare?
Canada? It's like remote.
Maybe I'd go to Mexico and eat more burritos.
Canada's closer. They speak English there too.
Not Canada.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
Space, because it's the final frontier.
Some people say that I'm living inside the fast lane. Some people say that I'm going.
Quick, name a big name film or TV show set in Minnesota. Now, name one that doesn't characterize our state as a bunch of funny talking, overly nice people. When it comes to the media, our fine state usually gets passed up by big studios. However, there are some directors and authors willing to tell stories set within the Land of Lakes, regardless of our accents. And reporter Alex Mertens talked with a few.
When pitching a big film idea, not many screenwriters say, "And let's set it in Minnesota." Those films that are made in the Land of Lakes are usually only filming there for the stereotypes. It's cold, the people talk funny, and there's hockey. So what draws people to the state for the settings of stories?
The story was set here in Minneapolis, and it's a pretty romantic story. It's about two people meeting or re-meeting, reconnecting, and they spend this one night wandering through all these familiar locations.
Speaking is Brady Kiernan, director of the film Stuck Between Stations, due for release on DVD next month. A local director, Kiernan was very motivated to work on the project, as it followed some very familiar locations to him.
I've had this exact experience. I've had this night. So it was something that I definitely immediately knew. This is a story I know how to tell.
The film was first released at the Tribeca Film Festival. According to Kiernan, it exceeded all the cast and crew's expectations. One of the constant worries was that such a local and heartfelt production might be misinterpreted by those who are unfamiliar with the state and the people as a whole.
We were showing it to an audience that wasn't going to understand that these people were going to First Ave, that they were listening to, you know, an atmosphere song at a party. Like, there's a lot of little touches of Minneapolis that a hometown crowd is going to understand, but a national audience might not necessarily get or might not have the same impact.
The fact that the director and both writers Sam Rosen and Nat Bennett are locals to the area is a great benefit to the film. They can avoid the pitfalls of stereotype and tell a true story about Minnesota for Minnesota.
And it was the kind of thing, like, I can't necessarily think of another film that utilizes this setting and this environment in the way that we did.
Yet it can't be denied, not many films are made in Minnesota. It seems like it'd be an easy sell. Minnesota has soaring cityscapes, beautiful natural scenery, and enough lakes to drown a horse. So why aren't many films made in Minnesota?
If you know the ropes and know what you're doing, it's absolutely not hard and not terribly expensive to shoot here.
Todd R. Lockwood, author of the recently released book Dance of the Innocents, also decided to use Minnesota as the setting for his story. While Rosen and Bennett were more focused on the modern side of Minnesota, Mr. Lockwood was more concerned with the Native American past and its effect on the present.
What if a city of 1 million people, 2 million people was moving around in some kind of grand pattern, but they weren't aware that they were doing it? And the only way you would be able to actually see this pattern is from a satellite.
Lockwood ties this to the Native American ghost dance based on research he did before the book's writing. In his research, he found the use of the Native American ghost dance as an example of collective behavior.
From the time it was first invented by a Native American of the Paiute tribe in Nevada, within 2 years, every tribe west of the Mississippi was doing the ghost dance.
Lockwood believes that Dance of the Innocents is a very visual story. He's already working with someone to turn the story into a screen treatment. While Kiernan, Bennett, and Rosen use the city as a true character in their story, Lockwood simply uses the city as a jumping-off point. Lockwood believes that if the film were to be made, the actual location of Minneapolis need not be used.
Right. There are, you know, actual, there are a couple of actual historical characters in there, but neither one of them really have direct ties to Minneapolis.
So why then does Lockwood choose Minnesota?
The idea needed a more or less a flat environment to make the this idea sort of make sense in your head.
Flat may not be a bad thing for stories like Lockwood's. Since the story resolves at a national level, it really doesn't matter where it starts. However, Mr. Cannon is more of the mindset that the city really should be used more often.
The typical things that people think of when they think of our environment is people with funny accents playing hockey. Whereas there's, you know, many, many other aspects to life here that don't get told.
Hopefully people won't stop noticing what the state has to offer as far as stories and people. For Culture Q, this is Alex Marinos.
Even though we're living in an age of worldwide connectivity, there are still cultural barriers that can keep us from understanding places on the other side of the globe.